European Liberal Forum is an umbrella organization for political foundations such as IDI and also think tanks such as, well, Critica Liberale. Giulio's specialty is secularism. I'm not sure if that's what he will talk about to us today. But in general, he's one of the intellectual thinkers, I think, in the European Liberal family. So I'm very happy that he's here with us today. And I'll give you the floor.
Thank you. Too good of you, Martje. I dobro jutro i hvala na pozivu. Ima oko 30 godina, ja sam učio malo što utro vrijeme je govorilo srpsko-hrvatski jezik. To nije dosta za neki politički govor i za neki normalni razgovor, ali vrlo dobro razumem vremenske prognoze, naročito pomorske vremenske prognoze. But I have now to shift very fast to English and... I would be very curious to know after this presentation how it can fit with what you are discussing in your own parties or think tanks, if existing, and so on. Every man has a property in his own person. If it were not for the total lack of gender neutrality in this sentence, but until a few decades ago, no one would care in any of our countries, one could think that this sentence, every man has a property in his own person, could deal with such biopolitical issues as abortion, gay rights, or euthanasia. But these issues were far away from the interests of the guy who first wrote this sentence, a man of the 17th century who, as all the people of his time, would likely not be in tune with today's liberal positions on these issues. It was John Locke in his Second Treatise on Government, 1690. The guy who probably set the birth of, let's say, proto-liberalism as a political theory. What is telling is how this principle can have ever profound and more profound effects on an ever-changing problems of our time. The property in his own person, that was the first, at first meant for the male, Protestant, heterosexual, native citizen, is now the more and more obvious domain of universal rights. Property itself was given by Locke the very political role of being a defense against the king's absolute power. And that political and not merely economical role has proved as much important in the 20th century. The experience of communism has proved that a free society can only be a polyarchic society in which the holder of political power does not also hold the economical power and the power over the media. As an Italian, as you can understand, this is very important. And self-determination of what Locke called every man, that is, every individual in our speech today, is today the very center of any liberal concern. To an extent, liberalism has so deeply shaped more than any other ideology the very civic and cultural fabric of the Western civilization in the contemporary age that nowadays liberalism and Europe, liberalism and the Western civilization, to an extent almost identify. Hence, defining liberalism is more difficult than it was before, for example, at the time when communism existed. Now, one can wonder whether a definition would be really necessary. I think it is, in order to have a critical control on one's own language. But we cannot expect it to be a prescriptive definition. It can only be a proposal and not the prescription of a particular use. And I think that the definition is also necessary in order to avoid confusion. Because otherwise, if we accepted as liberal whoever uses the label, the paradoxical consequence is that we should include in our family, for example, the anti-Semitic and anti-Western Russian party of Vladimir Zhirinovsky, the so-called Russian Liberal Democratic Party. And to the shame of us Italian liberals, Berlusconi too sometimes describes himself as liberal. There are other difficulties. One, the thing liberal and liberalism, unlike socialism, was born before the theory. It was born in the first half, more or less, of 17th century England, but the theory did not exist. It was some demands for political reform, religious reform, and economic reform that melted together in the Great Rebellion of the first part of the century. Second, think liberalism and theory, liberal theory, were both born before the name was born. The name liberal came out only in Spain, strangely enough, at the time of the Cortes de Cádiz, when they wrote the first Spanish constitution, defended by the British fleet during the French occupation, in the years 1810-1812, where, very tellingly, a liberal party was opposed to a servile party. Nowadays, no one would use the label servile party, but a lot of our foes had better use it. Third, liberalism does not coincide with one single philosophy, unlike, again, at least at the beginning, socialism. It has always been a philosophically polygamist theory. It married the very, very libertine in this trivial sense of the word. It married with empiricism, with the Enlightenment philosophies, with Kant's criticism, with idealism, positivism, instrumentalism, and from another point of view, with libertinism, with atheism, with Protestantism, and even with some rather maverick brands of Catholicism. Then liberalism, as I said, largely coincides with civilization, despite, of course, countless contradictions, and yet has a universalistic vocation. We all would like individual rights, the rule of law, liberal democracy to be much more universal than they actually are today. But it is not the common fruit of Western civilization as a whole, even though it grew on some typically Western cultural depositories. Without these depositories, there would be probably no liberal ideology and no liberal civilization. These depositories are, for example, the Greek classical philosophical tradition, the heritage of Roman law and common law, that is, the rule of law gradually led by liberal constitutionalism to cover even the production of new laws under the judicial review of ordinary or constitutional courts. Then the Western idea of the individual was instrumental in setting the condition for the possibility of the birth of liberalism. This idea of the individual that seems so obvious today in our eyes was born only in the Middle Ages, in the ancient Low Countries, and in northern and central Italy in the late Middle Ages, and is well visible, for example, in the material culture and in the figurative arts and literature of both regions. In the Flanders and in northern and central Italy, especially in Tuscany, for example, you see the evolution in figurative arts that gives to the individual as such an importance that it had not in the previous Byzantine models of art. For the central role and the incoercibility of individual conscience. That is something that was born with Christianity and improved by the rift caused by the Reformation that imposed to the individuals, to each single individual, to take side. And finally, the disenchantment of the medieval world, also an unintentional and joint result of both libertinism and of the Reformation, and the birth of modern science. And finally, tolerance. as a lesson that was taught to us by religious wars. Liberalism and tolerance as a value, and not as the consequence of the impotence of power to crush the dissent, are basically a Dutch, English, American, and French product. A product that proved capable in the last three centuries of being introduced, transplanted, copied, adapted, sometimes even improved, in very different cultural and political environments. So much so that almost no political force in our countries can today survive on a totally anti-liberal platform. At least they have to pay lip service to some of our basic principles, even when their policies openly contradict them. Hence, every definition of liberalism can only be what is called in social sciences an ideal type, that is, an abstract intellectual construction to which we can compare what exists in history and in our societies in order to be able to appreciate what is most liberal, what is least liberal, and of course what is most illiberal or most anti-liberal. We should therefore try to propose a definition, and this is my own proposal, and liberalism is a theory of the ends and a theory of the means, maximizing individual freedom and self-determination, mainly through the instrument of the legal limitation of power. If we accept this definition, liberalism is a perpetual work in progress. First, because from the very beginning it was connected to the fight against authoritarian traditions and beliefs. Second, because its economical means change with the different challenges we have to face. The brand of liberalism that was most recognized as such after World War II and until a few decades ago, the one that largely influenced the most of the political spectrum in the Western countries and the Western democracies throughout the Cold War, not only required the guarantee and the implementation of the individual liberties that were trampled by communist and other totalitarian regimes, but also included a push towards an even greater inclusion and empowerment of each individual in the actual exercise of his or her citizenship and liberal rights. That had originally been a typically liberal idea, born in the Victorian age, in the same country, England, that had given birth to liberalism 2 centuries before. The idea was that public powers should actually put the individual in the condition of making actual and real use of his or her liberal liberties. The welfare state was first conceived and designed by liberals as Keynes and Beveridge, who were card-carrying members of the British Liberal Party, not by socialists or social democrats. And for years, not only communists, but a lot of mainstream socialists had been accused of the wicked liberal economist John Maynard Keynes for having rescued capitalism from its certain downfall, thus preventing the rise of a happy global socialist society. It is, in fact, a fact that almost all national political classes and state bureaucracies had been long squandering since to their own advantage much of the benefits they were supposed to make available to a majority of citizens, and a healthy liberal mistrust towards every possible abuses committed by the holder of political power, and a less naive and more sober notion of democracy should have suggested that public is but by no means equivalent per se to caring for public interest. But as it frequently happens in politics and even in social sciences, an overreaction took place since the late 70s on both sides of the Atlantic, in the end substituting the liberal consensus that had been shared in most Western countries by the moderate left and the moderate right alike, while we were containing and opposing Soviet communism, with the so-called Washington Consensus of the 90s, and with its more extremist interpretations in the late 90s, that was more inclined to accept growing inequalities and inevitably also decreasing equality in opportunities. opportunities. In some countries, and namely in France, and elsewhere to a smaller extent, that essentially merely economical doctrine became synonymous with liberalism, to the point that the previous meaning, liberalism as synonymous for political freedom and freedom of conscience in the first place, had long been labeled as outdated by French dictionaries. So that even the Chilean Pinochet regime of the 70s and 80s can be defined as liberal in the present French political debate. Anyway, this new basically economical consensus, not the comprehensive liberal political views that embodied the Western opposition to communism from the 40s, more or less, to the late 70s, was the ideology upon which the globalized world was restructured after the fall of communism. At the beginning, that was a great success because of the enormous growth that was caused by more open societies in general, and by the opening of totally new and enormous markets. And most of all, by the simultaneous huge technological revolution, and later also to the practice of easy indebtedness. The subsequent global crisis, still ongoing, and the consequent discredit that the most radical interpretations of this Washington consensus are undergoing should not be allowed to drag liberalism into disrepute together with them. A liberal society cannot survive without a strong free market economy, not only because private enterprise is an expression of individual freedom, and because the economical development that it alone can make possible is necessary in order to achieve a satisfactory degree of human development, but also because a liberal society must be, as I said, polyarchic. Political power, economic power, and the power over the media should be as much separate as possible. Strong counterpowers to the political power are vital for a liberal society. And free trade is also the best guarantee for peace in a global world. Thanks to globalization, perhaps for the first time in history, the rise of a new global superpower as China is not leading to a war among the major powers, a war that today would be the global nuclear war that had been threatening the global world for 40 years. It is, however, not only an overdue tribute to historical accuracy, but also a statement of fact that different views on the extent of legitimate and suitable state intervention and different ideas on the desirable level of equality of opportunity have always been present in the history of contemporary liberalism. We should remember this while trying to find a way out of the present global crisis. But more Keynesians and more free trader liberals should have a common ground on the overriding importance that we both attach to the freedom and free development of the personality of each single individual. Freedom of speech, personal freedom, the right to a due process of law, protection from discrimination on the ground of ascribed identities like ethnicity, physical characters, age, disability, sex, gender, sexual orientation, or on the ground of political, cultural, and religious choices, and equal social dignity. The rule of law, human rights, liberal constitutional democracies are nowadays the shared heritage of the democratic political families across Europe. But they are all the outcome of liberal initiative, liberal imprinting, liberal intellectual leadership in the past, and we should be the most demanding interpreters of these principles today. The ever-impending risk of the tyranny of the majority is nowadays most notably visible in the debate concerning the rising and aggressive claims of religious fundamentalisms, both Christian and Islamic, in the new bioethical issues, prohibitionist policies, and the controversies over multiculturalism. All these issues, on all these issues, we should stick to the rule that basic constitutional principles are the only acceptable binding civil bonds of an open society, despite the claims of populists and religious fundamentalists. That is what some of us call the patriotism of the liberal Grundnorm, with an explicit reference to the Jürgen Habermas's idea of constitutional patriotism and to Hans Kelsen's idea of Grundnorm, for those who are familiar with these thinkers. This implies that the state or public powers could never be entitled to forcefully protect an adult and sane individual against him herself. Remember Locke, every man has a property in his own person. That individuals should always be treated as individuals and not as individual members of typified groups. That cultural diversity can never justify a compression of individuals' rights within minority communities or minority families, or those of minorities within minorities. That faith, ideas, and practices of their elders should never be forcefully imposed on those minors that are, I quote, capable of forming their own ideas, as stated by the New York 1989 Convention on the Rights of Children. No better institutional framework could be provided in order to protect these individual liberties and rights than that provided by our great and successful liberal tradition of religious neutrality and separation, as large as practically feasible, between religion and political power. This achievement was the converging result of the struggles both of deists, freethinkers, libertines, and immanentist or atheist philosophers, and that of religious minorities. In the new multi-religious situation, where many claim that the inter-religious dialogue is the only possible key to any peaceful coexistence, we should never forget that the fight for religious freedom and freedom of conscience was from the start a fight against the religious supremacy of the established churches, that at the time was in the form of compulsory uniformity and intolerance, and only in the end a fight against the scourge of state atheism in communist countries or against Islamic fundamentalism. The, I quote, wall of separation between church and state, as Thomas Jefferson defined it in 1802, is even today the most secure and effective tool to protect the freedom of conscience of each single individual. On the contrary, today many religious leaders demand a public recognition on the part of our states and on the of the European Union itself. That is almost wherever in Europe the demand of Muslim leaders. But other established religions, first of all the Roman Catholic Church hierarchy, are thus trying to seize the opportunity to ask for a renewed public role of all religions that would inevitably confine non-believers in the position of second-class citizens, like the dhimmis in the Ottoman Empire. Trying to impose on all of us, by law, personal behaviors only consistent with a faith that many of us do not share, and that even many more do not share in its official interpretation, as it is the case of tens of millions of Catholics in Europe. An even more open threat to our open societies come from those populist politicians that want no religious dialogue at all, but use their autochthonous religion or whatever other item they could find in their country's real or invented tradition as tools to exclude people of no or other religion, and the autochthonous individualists alike, from their regressive dream of a society they would like to make more cohesive and intolerant through a renewed authoritarian imposition of some kind of anthropological uniformity. Christianity is for them nothing more than an ideological weapon to be brandished against minorities and or against immigrants. Claims for national identities or for European identities that is based upon a single religion or indeed on one single culture are not candid or innocent claims. What is claimed here is an exegetic principle, a criterion to be implemented in the interpretation of the entire system of law, creating first and second class citizens. The biggest challenge of the present time is the paradoxical erosion of the most precious historical values typical of our common civic identity that is largely part of a cultural, acquis communautaire, by populist politicians who pose as the keepers of our real identity and tradition, and would like to cage all of us into closed, homogeneous, and mutually hostile communitarian enclosures. The smaller and the more controlled, the better. That is the opposite of liberalism. I mentioned that modern liberalism was not built upon the vacuum, but on some cultural depositories that were the heritage of previous periods in our history. In the most one of the most celebrated of them, the funeral oration of Pericles, he praised the freedom we enjoy, I quote, in our government, in Athens he meant, that extends also to our ordinary life. There, far from exercising a jealous surveillance over each other, we do not feel called upon to be angry with our neighbors for doing what he likes, unquote. And his unlucky successor, Nicias, mentioned the unfettered discretion allowed in Athens to all to live as they pleased. Nicias' Athens was defeated by the tyrants of Syracuse. It took more than 2,000 years for individual freedom to reappear after that brief ancient epiphany in the Netherlands, in England, in America, in France, and to retake roots after the two attempted suicide in Europe in the 20th century, in our countries and in the European Union. The liberals' task today is not only to defend, but to enhance and to expand those achievements, and to defend, strengthen, and democratize that European Union that is for us in the global world the only possible tool allowing us to have a say in a world where all our old individual nation states can no longer have a voice strong enough to be remarked or to be taken into account. Now, I'm sorry I was too long as always, but I would be very pleased if in the next few hours, inside or outside the public debate in this conference, you would be able to explain to me how much what I have said is fitting or not fitting with the debates you can have inside your own countries and inside your own political organizations. Thank you very much.